From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ice, crank, crystal, the potent street drug methamphetamine has many names and is quickly being absorbed into teenage drug culture in rural communities and now cities across America. In the Pacific Northwest, methamphetamine has become the favored hard drug, more widely used than crack, cocaine, and heroin. It's easily cooked over the kitchen stove out of pseudoephedrine from drugstore cold medicine and lithium metal from batteries. Now moonshine meth labs are cropping up in cities from Seattle to St. Louis to East Hartford, Connecticut. Earlier today, I spoke with Asa Hutchinson, director of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. I asked him to give us a sense of the meth problem in America.
Well, meth started in the early 80s, but it was limited to biker gangs. It was a very difficult production process, and so it was not a widespread problem. But in the 90s, they simplified the production process. They learned easier ways to make it. It became more widespread, and it is a growing, serious problem today. It really started on the West Coast, moved like a wildfire across the country, most significantly impacting rural America. In fact, it is the number one drug problem in rural America today. The usage among even people that work is a great concern. In fact, overall drug use, 75% of drug users are employed, and that's something that we fail to understand completely in the United States. But there is a growing concern as we see increased instances of this even on various parts of the East Coast. And we have to wonder whether it's going to become a nationwide problem where we have problems with methamphetamine everywhere.
Looking at your map of methamphetamine laboratories that have been discovered, it looks like such an erratic pattern. You've got Missouri with 2,000-plus labs that have been discovered, and then, you know, South Carolina with 8, Washington State with almost 1,500, and Maine with 2. What's the logic to the pattern of meth lab discoveries?
Well, the meth lab discoveries is just one measuring stick, and you have to be careful not to put too much weight just simply in that pattern. That sometimes is a reflection of good law enforcement work as well as good reporting for the local law enforcement officials. But it still reflects the overall trend, which you see that the major meth lab seizures occurs in the Midwest. It occurs in the rural states where the chemicals that produce it are readily available. But, for example, South Carolina, I was actually there, and they have two problems. One is the local labs that are seized, but also, as many states have, the meth that is coming through organized criminal organizations into that state. And so you get hit in double ways. In Massachusetts, very little is produced in local labs, but you have meth coming in increasing amounts into the state from organizations from across the country.
How much of the methamphetamine consumed in the United States is produced within the country, and how much do we know or think is imported?
Well, more than half of what is consumed in each individual state comes from out of state. Now, most of it does not come actually from Mexico, but it is produced in Southern California and in the western part of the country, even in Washington State, in large super labs that produce over 15 pounds of meth in each production cycle. And so that's the greatest concern, that which is manufactured on the West Coast, brought over across the country by these criminal organizations, and more than half of what is consumed in the country comes from these super labs on the West Coast. And they do have origins internationally because many of them are produced by Mexican national organizations with pseudoephedrine that comes from Canada that is originally manufactured in China. So there's always an international aspect to even the drug problems that we face in each individual state.
How would you rank the methamphetamine problem compared to other particular illegal drugs being used in the United States?
Well, in terms of predominance, it is the number one problem in rural America, but it is only one of many drug problems in urban America where we still have problems of cocaine, heroin, and ecstasy. What is unique about methamphetamine is the danger that it poses. That is the only drug that we have that is manufactured in the United States in a very dangerous process. And so the environmental damage, the harm that comes to children from being present around those labs, and the fact that it is incredibly addictive in nature creates dangers to law enforcement and the community as a whole that's not present with the other drugs.
When you say a danger to local law enforcement, what exactly do you mean, Asa Hutchinson?
When they go into the lab, you have the danger from anhydrous ammonia and the other chemicals that can cause extraordinary health consequences, both to the user but to law enforcement who will be dismantling the lab. Secondly, they have danger because the lab cook many times is using meth themselves for a couple of days, have reached the tweaking stage where they have a high state of paranoia, and they sometimes shoot on sight. They think everybody's out to get them, and so the danger from a meth cook is extraordinary for law enforcement, from the chemicals, but also from the potential for violence exchange at that lab site.
You've taken, over the last several months, a campaign called Not in Our Town, Meth in America, Not in Our Town, around the country. Why the focus on town by town? Is this a drug problem that cannot be as easily addressed nationally as some others?
Well, the drug problems in the United States have a local flavor to them. But our tour, it starts Meth in America, Not in Our Town, in which I'll be going to over 30 states in 3 months, talking about the problems of methamphetamine and looking for local solutions. And the reason is that some communities might even adopt a tax increase in order to fund law enforcement, treatment, and prevention programs like we saw in Jackson County, Missouri. Mm. Other communities have community coalitions that focus on the education side of it. Others look at how they can regulate with the retail community, restricting the availability of the medicines that go to make methamphetamine. So a lot of different solutions out there, but it's focusing attention on it, what more we can do with businesses, drug testing, employee assistance programs, what we can do in the schools, as well as with the policymakers.
So it sounds as though this is much a drug war, much less focused at the border than for cocaine, for example, much more internally focused.
That is exactly right, because this is one drug that we cannot blame on our South American neighbors. This is something that can be produced here, and its easy availability of chemicals as well as its production methods makes it attractive for those people who want to manufacture small amounts for their own consumption. And so you have to address it uniquely with community solutions, with better education, as well as strong law enforcement effort.
Asa Hutchinson, what are the effects of this drug on a user over time?
Devastating health-wise. You have physical disability almost that results in your appearance from the continued use of this. The aging process is enhanced. It gets into your mind where increases your paranoia. It has health consequences. I think they're still studying and learning more about as to its devastating impact.
Asa Hutchinson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Asa Hutchinson is director of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency and former member of Congress from Arkansas. He spoke with me earlier today from Indianapolis. In some rural communities, law enforcement officials estimate that as many as 25% of teenagers have now used methamphetamine. In major cities, it's becoming the cranked-up club drug with a higher high than ecstasy and far more damaging consequences. Why are more Americans, more teens, turning to high-powered, high-danger methamphetamine as their drug of choice? And what does that say about a changing drug culture in America? Is this the next crack epidemic in the making? Is America dealing with its homegrown drug threat? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Alex Stalka, medical director of the New Leaf Treatment Center in Contra Costa County, California. Good evening and welcome, Alex Stalka.
Good evening.
Also with us is tonight's On Point news analyst, Lewis Gordon, director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Hello, Lewis.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Alex Stalka, take us into some of the basics here, if you'd be good enough to begin. What is meth? Is it the same as speed? What are all the words we've all heard it by? Is it the same as amphetamines that have been around for a long time? What are we talking about here?
Amphetamine's been around since World War II and were actually used by both sides during the war to help troops combat fatigue, stay awake, and the like. And Japan had a large amount of methamphetamine stored, and at the end of the war, that material became available to the street. And Japan had the first of its, now I think, four or five very serious methamphetamine epidemics.
I've read that amphetamines were tried by Allied bomber pilots to sustain them on long flights, but it failed because they became too irritable and couldn't channel their aggression, that Japanese kamikaze pilots may have used this?
There are stories to that effect, and there's probably truth to it. The Allied experience was disappointing because although it did keep people awake, it made them aggressive, and it was hard for them to direct their aggression towards the enemy. They just became irritable and hard to be around.
In general. These were then marketed as obesity drugs or weight control drugs?
Well, amphetamines are basically drugs that are close cousins to a natural occurring substance in the body, namely adrenaline. So it has all the properties of increasing heart rate, increasing metabolism, and increasing the rate of thought. It's a stimulant drug similar to adrenaline. And there's a whole family of stimulants that have been used for a variety of purposes in America. They have been used in cycles as weight loss agents. Unfortunately, they work for a time and then stop working, and very often that's when people get into trouble with them because they escalate their dose.
Now, I remember as a teenager seeing truck drivers using what we called speed, Bennies, pep pills. Is that the same as methamphetamine?
Well, in the 50s and 60s, there were pill forms of amphetamines available, and you highlighted truckers, which was a group that got into a lot of trouble using amphetamines during that time. When at the end of World War II, methamphetamine, the illicit drug, migrated across the Pacific and established a foothold in San Diego, and almost immediately was taken up for cooking and distribution and sales by outlaw motorcycle gangs, a la the Hell's Angels. And in California, it was for decades really the province of outlaw motorcycle gangs. They were the people who cooked it and distributed it, and it was largely used by lower class whites on the West Coast, and was sort of a chronic low-grade problem. Beginning in the mid-80s, a new form of methamphetamine became available, which was originally termed ICE. The critical difference between the old biker-era speed and this new drug is that the starting material was changed from P2P in the old stuff to ephedrine or pseudoephedrine in the new stuff. When you start with the new material, you end up with a product that is, number one, much, much more potent than the old biker-era speed, much more so. And number two, it is now a drug that's rendered in a smokable form. And if you look at people's aversion to using drugs, aversion to needles is high on the list. Historically, whenever a drug increases its potency and bypasses the needle to be administered, the ground is set for an epidemic. And from 1986, when we began first seeing what we called ICE on the streets of San Francisco, to now, the drug has become, in the West, an explosive problem.
We're going to talk about that. I want to bring Lewis Gordon in for just a moment before our break. Lewis Gordon, we seem to be moving here toward more dangerous drugs. This is a drug that can have long-term consequences, and we'll talk about them. What's going on? This isn't any kind of gentle high. It's hard in the high and dangerous in the consequences.
Indeed. If we look at the past 40 years, it seems to be each decade we get a new drug with greater potency. It was striking what Asa Hutchins was saying earlier in terms of some of the responses he had in mind. He wanted to get particularly the question of the source. We're talking about something that functions within the illicit or the illegal economy. And to put it in a nutshell, there is a demand for it. And in many ways, if we're going to deal with the rise of this epidemic, we face a situation around trying to articulate the conditions that make it, you know, attractive or in high demand.
So once again, we're talking about where's the demand, and we're talking about methamphetamine. They call it the poor man's cocaine. It's been big on the West Coast for a long time. It is now spreading from rural areas on the West Coast right across the country. What does the boom in meth say about American society and law enforcement? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
Tonight about methamphetamines. Law enforcement officials fear that we may be seeing the next crack-style epidemic in the making. Usage is on the rise all across the United States. Interestingly, it came out of rural areas into urban areas this time. It's moving from west to east, and it's moving into the teen culture. What do you think? Why are we moving to more dangerous drugs? And how do we deal with this made-in-America drug threat? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Alex Stalkup tonight. He's medical director for the New Leaf Treatment Center in Contra Costa County, California, in the Bay Area there. And now by Sheriff Rick Bart. He's sheriff in the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office near Seattle. Good evening and welcome, Sheriff Bart.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. Sheriff Bart, tell us, if you would, about what's going on with meth in your jurisdiction, in particular about teen users of methamphetamines. What have you seen an increase? How widespread is usage? How big is the problem in your neck of the woods?
We've seen a really significant increase in the use of methamphetamines and club drugs in our county. We have about a 650,000 population here, and in the last 2 years, we've seen the discovery of meth labs just jump astronomically, almost 100%. And with that came the realization that we've probably got 25% of our teenagers who are using the methamphetamine drug right now.
And 25%? That's one in four using regularly or tried it once? Or
well, I don't think they can try it once. One of the problems with this drug is once they try it, they got to keep using it. So we think at least one in four has had that experience and has had the real difficulties in either trying to get off the drug or trying to make some kind of an effort to stop.
And are we talking about high school users here?
We're talking anywhere from middle school on up.
You lumped together club drugs and methamphetamines. We typically have thought of ecstasy, which it has its own problems, but is often thought of as relatively mild. Are these somehow, is this now a progression or from one to the other?
Well, what we're finding in our community is, what we believe anyway, is the club drugs have a definite correlation to the methamphetamine problem we're having, and that we find one and the same. In other words, we have a drug problem. When we go to a rave party, we notice the same problems we would if we went to a place where people are using methamphetamine.
Do kids even know at a rave party, at a dance club or a dance party, whether they're taking ecstasy or meth?
Well, I don't know if they know. I think they know they're taking something. But what we're trying to do here in our county is educate them about what exactly they're taking and what the consequences are of that act. Because once they do that, we believe that they're going down a road they cannot return from.
Have you seen that addiction set in hard and fast with even teenage users?
Yes, it has. It's been very sad. We've seen many families in my county completely broke up and disrupted by the use of methamphetamines, either by the teenagers or by their parents.
Wow.
And it's just been a very sad, sad thing for us.
Sheriff Rick Bart, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You bet.
Sheriff Rick Bart is Snohomish County Sheriff. That's outside Seattle. Listeners, have you seen meth in the clubs in your neighborhood? What's pushing this change, this move to methamphetamines? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Alex Stalkup, talk to us about how people take this drug. Is it pills? You said smoked? What's the range of ways of taking meth?
Most people get introduced to methamphetamine by snorting it. After a while, the high isn't so intense, and at that point, people are often tempted to switch to smoking the drug. Smoking it is a very dangerous form in the sense that it produces an extremely intense, immediate onset high, very, very addicting sensation. And I think one of the issues that's been left out of the discussion of methamphetamine is why it's so addictive. And in our view, the answer is it feels very, very good.
So it's not just a kind of a adrenaline rush, but there's a euphoric aspect to it as well?
There's a sense of rapture, of elation, a sense of being thrilled, a wonderful sense of power, omniscience. Sheriff Rick's got it right. When kids try this drug, they absolutely love it. But the other side of the coin on methamphetamine is, and one of the things that definitely fuels its repeat use, is that after fairly limited use, people find that sobriety begins to be a problem. They begin to have mood swings, down periods, sleep problems.
I mean, when they're not high, they're in trouble.
When they're not high. And probably the principle here is one of the most important principles of addiction, which is that drugs injure sobriety. the aspect of sobriety that drugs in general and meth in particular damages is your ability to experience pleasure, your ability to enjoy.
Normal, natural pleasure, not on drugs.
You become burned out to normal pleasures. I mean, what goes up has to come down. And the high from meth is very high. And if you've ever seen a 12-year-old coming off of methamphetamine, as I have many times, it will break your heart.
What do you see?
They're simply not prepared for the devastating hopelessness, helplessness, a symptom called dysphoria, where they feel so bad you want to take them in your arms and just hold them. Mm. It's a wrenching, vile come down. And a lot of people won't come down, that once having come up, they'll definitely prefer the high to the low.
Does that mean criminal problems as people try and get the money together to buy more meth?
When people engage in a methamphetamine binge and run out of meth, they face coming down. And our experience has been that they will do literally anything. They'll do what it takes to get more methamphetamine. And the level of desperation sometimes does lead to criminality, to prostitution, to theft, and on and on. This is a drug that, after fairly limited use, produces desperation in the users to a high degree.
Wow. What about the longer-term consequences? And it sounds like longer-term is not very long here, but what are the consequences of repeat users on their psychological and physical health?
Methamphetamine makes you dumb. It makes you stupid. It's well understood that it damages important neurons in the brain, in particular the neurons that are responsible for thought and memory and learning. The addiction to methamphetamine, although it's possible to treat it, it's a tough road. It takes about a year for the typical methamphetamine addict to get some sobriety that they can tolerate. Mm. So it's a long course of treatment, and during that time, they're going to experience a lot of problems with pleasure, with sleep. It's and for children who are unprepared for such severe symptomatology, it's a frightening experience that typically has them trying other drugs or multiple drugs to try and mitigate the very bad feelings that beset them for up to a year after they try and stop.
Wow. Lewis Gordon, it sounds like a super high, but a brutal aftermath.
Sure. There's a lot of irony here, since we're in an age of heightened libertarian language about choice, that there are so many people opting to use something that will destroy the very mechanism through which to make these choices, namely their brain.
And the very mechanism by which they might experience joy in the rest of their life.
Right. I mean, yeah. And if there were a philosopher speaking, the philosopher would probably say that this is symptomatic of what's called nihilism or a lack of hope. But the question is, what would make that initial use, you know, why would they turn to that initially? And this might be part of a larger sense of there being aspects of society over which they may not have many options. For instance, we're in the age of the quick fix. You know, there's in comedy, there's an expression, can't I just take a pill? Mm-hmm. And in many ways, if we look at a lot of what, in the cases that are not necessarily raves, you know, if we're talking about the rural regions or truck drivers and others, there's a circumstance in which they're looking for a quick fix solution. And in many ways, this is what starts this unfortunate road.
We're going to come back to talk about that culture, but I want to invite our callers in. Listeners, what do you think? Is meth headed toward being the next crack, the next epidemic? And what is the engine driving the spread of methamphetamines? Ryan is on the line. Welcome, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm a guidance counselor, and I've also had a lot of experience in the drug culture just from the rave scene and the club scene. Mm-hmm. And what I think is important for everyone to understand is that we have a generation of kids who's now grown up on psychostimulants like Ritalin and Adderall. And to those kids, getting amped up on Crystal, as it's called on the East Coast, mm-hmm. is no big deal.
I mean, you're talking about Ritalin then as an entryway drug?
Absolutely, because kids, they crush it up, they snort it. And, you know, and that whole idea of that kind of rush, you know, is something that's not foreign to kids. You know, so this is a potentially huge epidemic we can have. What I think is needed is non-judgmental, non-biased drug education. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's lacking.
So, Ryan, have you seen usage among your students?
Not my students, but I've seen plenty of kids on it. at rave parties and such.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, thanks for the call. Alex Talkup, what about this? We've got two lines of thought raised here. Lewis Gordon says, what is it in our culture, our sped-up culture, that might lead us to the doorstep of meth? Our caller Ryan says, well, kids are so often medicated these days that it's a short step from there to illegal drugs.
I'd like to answer that.
Well, it's actually interesting. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
It's an interesting
question
because it's useful to ask the question of what a drug is. And the modern definition of a drug is that for a drug to be considered a drug, you have to show that it augments activity in the pleasure and reward centers of the brain. In other words, a drug is a pleasure-producing chemical. Well, America is a bored society. Because we're so stimulated, and with advertising and the like, people and marketing people have learned how to reward us. We're bombarded by high energy, high stimulation, pleasure, and reward.
That doesn't sound boring. That sounds like, as you say, high stimulation.
But that's the cost. Whenever you stimulate the brain, and in this case we're talking about pure stimulation mm-hmm. with a stimulant drug, the brain adapts. And the effect of the brain's adaptation to being stimulated is it becomes resistant to being stimulated. Mm-hmm. So the consequence of repetitive high levels of pleasure stimulation is boredom when you're not being stimulated. Mm-hmm. Well, there's two good reasons why bored people should not use drugs. The first reason is that they work. People like them because they get a reawakening of simple pleasures, high pleasures, and they recapture pleasure that through conditioning and overstimulation they've lost.
But an artificial pleasure in that case.
Completely chemical. The second reason is that after you've used a drug to give yourself pleasure, you will experience greater pleasure. Drugs injure the chemistry that they use to make you high with. Mm-hmm. So after you've used a stimulant to feel better, after you've used any drug to feel better, you'll feel worse than you did before you start. So
it doesn't sound like a great formula there. Lewis Gordon,
you can't win.
Yeah, what do you make of that? That Alex Stalkup is saying we're an overstimulated and ultimately bored society, and there's the seedbed for meth use.
I was also thinking about what the caller Ryan pointed out, which is more and more children are being introduced on a mundane level to drug use. If you know the idea, that point I made before of the quick fix with the pill or anything like that, I think what he was alluding to is the idea that people are being socialized into drug use in such a way that dangerous drugs don't appear as high risk to children as they may have in the past.
So we're getting socialized to this. Alex, Lewis, stand by. I want to welcome in Lynn Yule. Lynn is drug prevention coordinator with the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office. She's a former meth user herself, started when she was about 20. She's been off meth for 15 years now. Good evening and welcome, Lynn Yule.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Lynn, we heard earlier from Sheriff Rick Bart about the scale of the problem in Snohomish County. It sounds frightening. You've been involved in trying to raise the flag of awareness and push back against methamphetamine use. How's that going?
Well, I think we could say we've slammed the denial of our community most recently. First and foremost, I commend Sheriff Rick Bart and the leaders in our community for having recognized an epidemic before we've gotten so out of control that we have thousands of children coming into treatment and not the facilities to withstand that pressure. I also want to say that Dr. Stalkup is probably the best medical professional I've heard talking on this subject in the last 15 years of my career, and I commend him for that.
What do you think makes methamphetamine so appealing to teenagers, Lynn Yule?
I would say that everything you've stated thus far on the instant gratification, the lack of stress control measures with children today do not know how to deal with stress and boredom. There's all sorts of reasons for why it starts. I also think you have to look at that drugs are more potent now today than they've ever been. You don't start off with a slow drug or a mild drug. You start off with a very potent marijuana, such as we have in the Pacific Northwest, the most potent marijuana in the world. So if you're starting off with nicotine before you even reach the age of puberty, let's say you're 10, 11, 12, you start smoking nicotine and the pathways to your brain are then set up for addiction. You maybe start trying marijuana and that tolerance level is already increased, and boom, 13 years old, and methamphetamines at your school.
You actually held last month a youth methamphetamine summit. What was that about? Was it successful?
It was more than successful. We have now had calls from across the country to try to duplicate it. We had nearly 1,000 students in attendance. We planned it in less than 10 weeks. It came out of a adult methamphetamine summit held January of this year, in which we had to stop attendance at 500. We had to shut the doors, and out of that meth summit for adults came six meth action teams, which includes the prosecution side, cleanup of labs, restriction of chemicals, treatment, and one of those youth meth action teams was a group of students, all middle school, approximately about 25, 14-year-olds who started this summit committee and said, we want a summit before the school year ends. So
here's the students themselves calling for something to be done.
They demanded it.
That's pretty incredible. Lynn Yule, it sounds like you're really wading into the problem. We thank you for sharing with us some of the way that you're doing that tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Lynn Yule is Drug Prevention Coordinator with the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office near Seattle. William's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, William. You're on the air.
Good evening. I had a couple points I wanted to make. I've been clean now for probably 10 to 15 years. Once it came out with a new federal CDL license, most of my generation dropped the stuff.
William, what context were you using meth in? Were you, at parties or at work?
At work.
What kind of work?
We used meth to stay awake.
What kind of work did you do, William?
But it was very addictive and it was very hard. But none of us are experiencing the health problems that these young kids are using.
Well, my producer saying you were a truck driver when you were using meth?
Yes.
And do you think that there's some difference, perhaps, between the drugs you used 20 years ago and the drugs available today?
Yes. Yeah, they outlawed the chemicals 20 years ago that they make this stuff out of, that they were making the stuff out of. Now they're making it out of battery acid and anything else they can find.
William, do you see young truck drivers or older truck drivers using meth today? Is it still a drug that keeps people awake and following the white line?
Yeah, there's still some that still use it. Yes, they do.
And they're able to drive safely?
That's a borderline. That's an honest borderline. My friends and I tend to try and corner them and get them into a program if we can to get them off the road.
William, thanks for your call. I want to put this real quick to Alex Stelkup. What about this notion, Alex, that William raises, that 20 years ago they used it, they seemed to survive it? Is that because we've just got 20 seconds before the break, but are the drugs significantly stronger today?
No, your caller's absolutely right. With the advent of the new cooking procedure using ephedrine or pseudoephedrine, this speed that's out on the street now is at least three times, and by some calculations, as much as six times more potent than back when William was using the drug. And the health consequences are much more immediate and much more severe, paralleling the potency in the drug.
We're talking about methamphetamines tonight. Their use has come out of rural America. It's huge on the West Coast. It's moving east. It's moving into cities and the mainstream. Why are we moving to more dangerous drugs? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is WBU.
On Point, we're talking tonight about methamphetamines, the drug craze, sometimes called the poor man's cocaine, that has moved out of rural America, where many of the chemicals were widely available, into the cities, into all kinds of adult communities, and now deep into teenage communities. What does the boom in meth say about American society? Is meth turning the club, the rave culture, deadly? And what's the engine driving the spread of methamphetamines? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Alex Stelkup. He's medical director of the New Leaf Treatment Center in Contra Costa County, California, outside San Francisco. And now by Kate. Welcome, Kate. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hello.
Sure. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in with this and see if your in-studio guests have any comment on this. I know about 10 years ago, the rave culture and the club scene was very underground. So there was a community based on kind of being this outsider, and people were very into protecting each other. So if kids were doing drugs in the club, particularly E, there was kind of a communal consciousness.
And when
about
you say
that.
E, Kate, you mean ecstasy?
I mean ecstasy, mm-hmm. Yes. It's a much more social drug. But crystal meth seems to be a much more individualistic drug. It's more about you and how you're feeling as opposed to kind of bringing in other people's experiences.
So do you think crystal meth has changed the club scene, or has the club scene changed and brought in somehow meth in its wake of change?
I think that in an effort to crack down on the use of ecstasy and closing down all of these underground independent clubs, what we've seen is that instead of having these underground clubs, now we have more mainstream clubs holding the parties. So the club goers have changed.
Kate, you raised so many interesting questions there. Let me put it to Alex Stalkov. I guess, Alex, what about the club scene? How important a base for meth use is it? Do you hear what Kate's saying about a change in the club environment? What's going on there?
I think she's made some very sophisticated points. The club scene has become mainstream in terms of teen culture. And if you look at the factors that perpetuate and lead to spread of drugs, whenever a culture, particularly a youth culture, forms around a drug, for example, when the hippie culture formed around LSD, mm-hmm. and now we have the rave culture initially promulgating MDMA, ecstasy, but the club scene basically has been the vehicle by which methamphetamine has become legitimized in teen life in rural and suburban America.
But when you say club scene, I don't picture rural America just being peppered with, you know, clubs. What are we talking about here? This isn't a traditional nightclub, are we talking disco? Or are we just talking the neighborhood kids party on a Saturday night?
Well, it's not a question so much of where the clubs are. It's a question of their impact on youth culture, and there has grown up a whole style of clothing, of speech, mannerisms, music, that are all related to the club scene. And so it's the culture that spread beyond the limits of the clubs per se.
And is the club got a physical place, or are we just talking about any place where a certain style of music is being played?
Well, I think there's almost no place now in America where you couldn't, with a minimum of effort, find a rave or a club to go to where you can be exposed to these drugs. Mm-hmm. But more and more and more, we're finding that with this secondary culture forming around language and music and speech and so forth, fashion, that serves to legitimize a lot of these drugs, and in particular, methamphetamine was sort of looked down upon out here as sort of a blue-collar and lower-class drug.
In California.
When it came in through the back door, namely through the club drug scene, mm-hmm. it developed a legitimacy that it had never had before. And we're seeing a lot of teens who would, 2 years ago, disparaged meth and meth users, now using the drug actively because it seems that through the club scene and the culture that it spawned, that it's much more legitimate, much less aversive, and more desirable to do it.
Mm. Kate, thanks for your call. Alex, talk up along those lines. In my generation, and maybe yours, the youth culture looked at adult disapproval of marijuana use and laughed at it. It was reefer madness. They thought the music was crazy, and they just didn't get it. Do youths now look at you when you try and discourage them from meth use and say, oh, it's cool, it's fine, man, just, you know, chill?
Well, the good reputation of a drug often precedes its bad effects, because usually it takes persistence of a drug in the community for some period of time before the really horrific effects start to appear. So part of it's just plain old ignorance. Mm-hmm. They haven't seen the full effect. And I think that without some peers who have actually been on the roller coaster of meth, who can talk about how it took hold of them and took them down, a lot of teens do look upon traditional drug education messages basically as bogus. You put your finger on it in a way, because the whole discussion around cannabis, marijuana, has distorted the drug dialogue.
In what way?
Well, cannabis is a drug that has an enormous high acceptance, and there's a lot of talk that youth hears about what a deadly drug it is. And in fact, in their experience and in the experience of the people around them who use it, it isn't deadly.
So it undercuts the credibility of people who then say, watch out for meth.
it very much sabotages the credibility. And don't get me wrong, the new forms of cannabis are very, very strong, and we see people become compulsive in their use of cannabis and get into a lot of trouble with it. But the message is that – the official message has been that marijuana is lumped in with heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine. So when kids hear the same dialogue being directed towards methamphetamine that they've already learned to ignore with marijuana, the message is damaged.
There may be important honest distinctions to make here.
Well, let me tell you, there is an honest distinction. Methamphetamine is a truly dangerous drug. It's dangerous through and through. On the other hand, there are many, many people who use cannabis, and it's a part of their life, and they actually function quite well.
Let's try and get one more call in. Bernard is on the line. Welcome, Bernard. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I had one question, which was just a clarification, because it's commonly called crystal, right, which was when crystallization of meth became possible.
Yes.
Okay, so, and then the point that I wanted to make is I think the distinction is between X and meth in clubs is that meth is much cheaper and it lasts much, much longer. It's much more smooth on the way up. I think that's the reason why it has been and will be more and more popular.
Have you used it, Bernard?
Yeah.
And did you suffer the kind of aftermath that we've heard Alex Stelkup describe?
Yeah, it's horrible. The come down is horrible, but another point, and this was years ago, but I think the drugs, I can imagine they're stronger. And but I don't think people realize at all that it's danger. I think on the street, meth is promoted as a drug that stops you from drinking. One, you have no desire to eat, and it's cheaper.
So more bang for the buck, plus you stay thin. Bernard, thanks for your call. Alex Stelkup, it sounds like almost a fashion drug when it's sold that way.
He's right. Brad's right on target. We've seen another phenomenon that's occurring all over the country. If you go to a rave and you buy what's being sold as MDMA or ecstasy, called E or X, actually, about a third, maybe as much as 40% of it, isn't ecstasy, and the most common contaminant that we see around the country actually is methamphetamine. So a lot of children are being introduced to methamphetamine, their first or second experience, because they thought they were buying and they thought they were using ecstasy. But Brad's right. It's cheaper.
What a surprise.
It lasts longer.
We're almost out of time. We've hardly touched on the fact that it's made in labs that could be anybody's backyard. We see a U.S. DEA agent quoted saying, it's as easy to follow as a Betty Crocker recipe. If you can make fudge brownies, you can make methamphetamine. You buy that, Alex?
Well, the recipes are on the net. A trained chimpanzee can make methamphetamine, and trained chimpanzees do make methamphetamine. It is very easy to make, and it's easy to crystallize. And some people take a lot of snobbish pride in the fact that they make better crystal than other people, and they market theirs as gourmet speed.
Is this still on the way up, or are we reaching a peak? How do you see the phenomena?
I see it with irritation. Let me tease you a little bit. Those of us out here in California and Washington State are shop-worn and war-weary. We've been head-to-head with this very, very nasty drug now going on 10 or 15 years. And we sometimes tell each other in joking that it's not an epidemic until it hits the East Coast. It's a full-blown epidemic here. And the tragedy and the suffering that it causes is fully as great as the crack epidemic ever did.
Alex, we're listening tonight, and we're helping it be heard across the country. We're out of time, but we thank you so much for joining us.
It's my privilege. Thank you.
Alex Stelkup is medical director at the New Leaf Treatment Center in Contra Costa County, California. Lewis Gordon, we've just got 20 seconds left, but this is one tough nut.
Indeed. We're dealing with something on the scale not only epidemic, but it's showing all the features that we'll find in horror. In many ways, the music, I first heard that from the movie Blade, and it seems right now the pushers are trying to create a nation of new vampires.
Lewis Gordon, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, closing the book on a trying school year, a graduating senior looks back on drugs, death, and the shadow of September 11th. This is On Point. Yeah. Last Saturday, Jason Jude Lonano walked for his high school diploma. In this diary, the 19-year-old from Medford, Massachusetts, looks back on a year marked by tragic personal and world events, how those events converged to change his life, and how he thinks now about his future.
You know, I was looking forward to hockey season, looking forward to different things throughout the year. I liked all my teachers. You know, I was just looking forward to having a good year, and then just certain things kind of just started to gel together and made it a difficult year. Well, September 11th was a big thing this year. You know, it hit many people, but it hit my family personally because two of my cousins and my uncle were in the World Trade Centers. My uncle got out okay, and then one of our cousins, we heard from about 3 hours after it happened. But my other cousin, we didn't hear from until the next night at 11 o'clock. So, you know, everything's running through our mind, like, is he trapped? Is he alive? Thank God everything came out all right with that. And then, you know, after September 11th kind of passed, took a little while to get over that. And then a close friend of mine passed away. He overdosed on OxyContin, which is the powerful drug of the 2000s now in the city. And then I lost one other friend. Heroin overdose. I actually went to school with him and played hockey with him my whole life, and he died. It was tough. I looked at the situation and was like, wow, you know, September comes and then the World Trade Center bombings happen. It's like, all right, you step back, you look at it again, you know, you get focused, you don't worry about those things, and you start to move forward again, and then a friend dies. And then, you know, you put him to rest and you go to step forward again, and another person dies. And after a while, I mean, after all this keeps happening, you kind of wonder when is it going to end, you know, and you talk to your parents about it and you talk to counselors and stuff like that. My father said to me, you know, Jay, it's not the first person you've seen die and it's not the last person you're going to see die from an overdose, and that just kills me because you don't know who's next. It does catch up with you easy. Last summer, I fell into a little trouble with drugs, you know. I knew I had a problem, so I went to my parents and I spoke to them, and, you know, my father sat down with me and was like, what do we need to do to help you? You know, do you need to go into a rehab? Do you need to do this? And I was like, no, Dad, I think I can do this on my own. And he helped me out, and I didn't have to go into a rehab. I stayed home with my family and got the rest that I needed. Now I thank God that I look back and, you know, I can say that I stopped and I'm clean. But I was still doing the drug now. I mean, I don't know where. I could be dead just like other kids. There's so much more to look forward to. And after September 11th, that kind of just put in perspective to, you know, step back and see what's really important in our lives. Don't take anything for granted, because in a day you could be going to work just like those people in the World Trade Center, and it could be taken away from you like that. I think I definitely look at things differently. I just kind of think, if I'm doing something, is it a good thing or a bad thing? And if it's going to hurt people, I don't want to do it. If it's going to hurt my parents, I don't want to do it. If there's a chance I could die, I don't want to do it. I've seen too many deaths. I've seen too much stuff happen over the past year. I just kind of try and make myself make the right choices. It's like, what happens in the next year could change my life forever. What happens in the next week could change my life forever. There's just so much things that are unknown, you know, and that kind of scares me. But it's like, you can't live in that fear. And you have to go out and live your life the way that, you know, you're destined to do. It's scary, but it's exciting. I feel as though there's a time to grow up and a time to party, you know, and I'm just glad that I got out of the party scene and kind of wanted to do the right college thing. I mean, I look back, it's like, wow, you could have studied a lot more, and you could have gone to a better college, and you could have done so many things differently that could have bettered your life. So I think in college, I want to take it more serious than I did, because it's my life now, you know?
Well done today. Congratulations. Well done. Good luck to you.
Okay. You did well.
Good luck.
Congratulations.
Jason Jude Lonano lives in Medford, Massachusetts. He graduated from Buckingham Brown and Nichols High School in Cambridge, Massachusetts last weekend. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorio.